The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Well, good morning. It's lovely to look out and see many of my favourite lawyers and favourite businessmen in the room. We had a rugby league game on last night that I didn't get to watch because I was with a family member and she didn't have a television, but the NRL had for a while a song which was their theme song, and it went like this. I won't sing it to you. What a man, what a man, what a mighty fine man. And with a whole lot of pictures of guys doing damage to each other. And when I think of that song, I think of Elijah. What a man, what a man, what a mighty fine man. We don't have time to whiz through the whole of his life. It's only about 6 or 7 chapters in the Old Testament. Easy read, interesting read. We come now to a part of his life which some find a little embarrassing. Some scholars, to use the word lightly, so confused by the realities of life that they think that the chapter's in the wrong place. They say it is impossible to believe that after the magnificent triumph of 1 Kings 18, you can have this total burnout, despair, depression, please kill me, God. They say it's impossible to go from such a victory to such a defeat, apparently, which just shows, I think, that they know very little about the realities of life. And as so often happens, rather than treating the Bible with contempt, rather than treat ourselves with suspicion, because actually what happened here to Elijah is a not uncommon experience. So let's have a look at this. One of the things that the Bible says about Elijah, and it's interesting, we won't have time to look at it here, is how often the New Testament obsesses about Elijah. I think he's probably the Old Testament character probably mentioned more often or as much as any other, although he's only got 6 chapters in the Bible. That's quite extraordinary. But one of the things it says about him is that he is a man like us. So it's quite clear he's saying that he is made of the same stuff. He's got feet of clay inside his sandals, like you have inside your Italian-made leather shoes, wherever you get them from. That he is like us. And you have this contrast between this massive triumph where God acts visibly and miraculously in a way that he rarely does in the Bible. There's a mistake people have that the Bible is full of the miraculous and now we're almost empty of it. It's just a misreading. There are clusters of miracles, and Elijah is one of the clusters. Fire falls from heaven, etc. The rain comes according to Elijah's prayer. And in chapter 19, verse 3, we have these extraordinary words about this man, this mighty fine man. Elijah was afraid and ran for his life. The chapter before, he confronts the king, all his power, 850 prophets officially kept, and single-handedly he opposes the whole nation for their good. In this chapter it says, Elijah was afraid and ran for his life. What frightened him? A woman. She was a cranky woman, she was a powerful woman, she was a determined woman, but a woman makes a threat that she's going to have him killed. And he just runs. And it is, if you read the stories from 17 and 18, totally unexpected that he would crack. He's been under threat of life and death for years. He spent 3 years between his statement, there will be no rain and no dew even, apart from the word that comes from my lips. He lives on his own, which is a difficult experience to do for a while. All of us like a bit of time on our own. If you spend time with me, you really long for time on your own. But it turns everyone into an introvert, really. He has some time on his own. But years on your own of enforced loneliness does itself. Also, and you realise that your people are suffering drought and famine, which in those cultures means death. There's no, UN to help at that point. And it's all because of his personal conflict on behalf of God with the nation. Then he lives for a while in the heart of darkness, in the land where the deep infection of Jezebel has come from, and then he has this great confrontation. He then gets told the woman's trying to kill him, and he runs. And if you had a map, he runs out of her region up the north of Israel, sort of near Lebanon, out to the southern kingdom, Ben Beersheba, and then he heads off into the Sinai Peninsula where Horeb or Mount Sinai is. And he leaves his servant behind, which is kind of his, you know how some churches they have a team of ministers, they might have a senior minister, pastor, and then someone else. This is kind of sacks his team, sacks his servant. And verse 4, he goes off into the wilderness. He came to a broom tree and sat under it and prayed that he might die. I've had enough, Lord, he said. Take my life. I'm no better than my ancestors. And he lay down under the bush and fell asleep. Now, this is not like some child who says, if I don't have any ice cream, I'm going to die. You know, we use that, you know, where they say something about food or some Hollywood hunk is to die for. It's not that. He really wants to die. And just note the two key phrases he says, I have had enough, Lord. Take my life. So he's really reached a point of utter emotional, spiritual, probably physical exhaustion. And he wants to die. He's saying, I cannot take it anymore. It's all been too much. This whole conflict, which I thought was going to lead to a great renewal of the nation and hasn't. He just wants to die. He is, I would think, under any suggestion, he is suicidally depressed. He's hit total burnout, and he asks God to finish him off. I think understanding that it is not his place, even though depressed, to remove the life that God gives. It is hard sometimes to work out the difference between sadness and depression. It's a little bit like if you've had a cold, and some people who have colds call it a flu, and it's really a cold, and it's only when you get the flu that you realise that the cold is only a cold. And there's a tendency, I think, for people to mistake sadness with depression, but depression is this longer lasting, seemingly inexplicable sadness. It may have had an original cause and a trigger, but it becomes this long listlessness of I just can't, and this deep sadness. I've got a family member at the moment who's fallen into the edge of depression after some years of anxiety, and basically, as you probably know, if you have long term anxiety, you will probably experience depression. Like if you have, or if you have a friend who has long-term sickness, depression will almost certainly rear its head at some point. Depression is a kind of just emotional, physical, spiritual exhaustion, but of a long-term enduring sense, and in the end, sometimes it can be externally caused, but it can end up affecting the chemistry of the body. And at that point, you may need chemical help. I've been trying to convince this family member, take the antidepressants. If you've got a broken leg, to have a splint around your leg is a help. It may not be, it probably won't be for life. But do take it. You know, do give yourself a chance to get well. Well, Elijah, this extraordinary hero, wants to die. He's sick of serving God. He's sick of doing his job. And he wants out. Now, the interesting question to see is, what does God do with this guy? If you hung around churches at all, or around religious people, sometimes, they will sort of say, snap out of it. Don't you believe in God? How can you despair when there's a God who you know loves you? Don't you believe Jesus died for you? Don't you believe God has good plans for you? And you can almost feel as if you're being... I've never had this because I'm too superficial to be depressed, but I've had enough dear friends who've gone through terrible depression, and I personally hate depression. It makes me really angry sometimes in the way that it just disables people. Really magnificent people, and it just crushes them. Or they go through life doing their duty, but in their heart of hearts it's just murderously empty and dark. How does God treat the servant who says to him, I've had enough? Basically saying, you've asked too much of me. I'm broken. I'm burnt out. I can't keep going. How does he respond to him? Well, I want to suggest to you, and I don't want to... One of the fashions of our culture is to speak about what a harsh, nasty God the God of the Old Testament is. I found that emotionally annoying, because I know the God of the Old Testament, and he's not harsh and nasty. it's logically silly also because people contrast him with the God of Jesus, because Jesus is quite clear that the God of the Old Testament is his dad. So that this sort of conflict we make is artificial. But I want to look at point two there on the notes, the tenderness and the shrewdness of the true God. What does God do with this guy? Now, I'm not going to pretend. In fact, I look at the title that I'd like to say someone else made it up, but I think I might have. Depression, its causes and cures. You'd be right to think at the end of this, I want my money back. Right? This is false advertising. We've got a tiny suggestion of some of the causes and a tiny suggestion of some of the cures. My apologies for that. But we will look at the way in which some of the things that help some types of depression here in the way that God responds to his heroic servant. And I want to stress to you, this guy who throws perhaps the biggest dummy spit in the Bible, Jeremiah gets close, where he says to God, "You are like an unfaithful brook. You promised me water and there's none." That's pretty straight talking, I think, to God. And another time he pictures God like a bear that ambushes him on the pasture and grabs him by the hair and grinds his teeth into the gravel. So I think it's a line ball between Elijah and Jeremiah. But these are men who know God, love God, serve God, but have times when they just say, this has just been far too much. Look at the way God deals with this guy. He lies down to have a sleep, having asked God. I presume he's asked God to kill him. He presumes he's going to go to sleep and God will euthanize him when he's asleep. What happens is he goes to sleep and then an angel touches him and says, "Get up and eat." God sends an angel. And you'll know most of the times when angels turn up, they're kind of frightening to see. Not like the ones in the stained glass windows, which are kind of fluffy and sweet. Why does God send his angel? He sends him to cook. Right? This messenger comes from heaven and his job is to cook Elijah some fresh bread. I don't know if you've ever woken up in a house where fresh bread is cooking. We had a period in our family where we had one of those bread makers. It was fantastic. You could turn it on and it would start doing its work at 3 a.m. and you'd wake up at 6 a.m. and there'd be this fantastic smell. And Elijah wakes up camping. The angel touches him, doesn't have to touch him. He could have just said, "Hey, wake up." But the angel touches him with a gentleness and says, "Get up and eat." So God sends an angel to cook, to awaken him. He wakes up and eats, and there's some water there as well, a jar of water, reminiscent of some of the earlier stories with Elijah. He ate and drank and lay down again. And then the angel comes back a second time and touches him and says, "Rise up and eat." And then he heads off for his journey up to Mount Horeb. Just the thing to notice here is, the way that I think, without making too much of it, the way that God deals with his physicality. Very often we get depressed because of we are physically exhausted. Now that might not mean that you've run a marathon, because you probably know there's this whole adrenaline system that our body's got. And if you're living an exciting, pressure-filled, stress-filled, important life, you will probably find, if you read some of the stuff by Arch Hart and some of these other guys who are were world leaders in this area, the whole adrenaline thing wears your body out. And if you have an emotional high, your body will tax you. It will send you into depression to rebuild, just momentarily. So one of the things you might be aware of, and when I was in youth work, we used to warn the kids of this. It's very common for kids having finished the HSC, which is a silly little exam that we lay so much pressure on, for kids after that to go into a momentary depression. What can happen then is they really panic then, because they think, "Crikey, I should be happier than ever." But it's the most natural thing in the world. They've had a horizon. They've had this high stress thing. Because all the way through school, people say, "Don't panic, it's not the HSC. It's not the..." They're saying that in primary school. "It's not the HSC." So when you finally come up against the HSC, this is it. This is the thing you're supposed to panic about. And so it's common that after the exhaustion, the late nights, the coffee for the first time, that the people fall into a depression. Because it's just what the body does. It needs to regroup. It needs to build itself. So physically, God takes his physicality seriously and says, "Elijah, rest." He doesn't sort of burst onto the scene and say, "So you want to die, do you? You think it's all been too hard, do you, pansy? You think I'm not strong enough to help you?" He doesn't. He says, "Sleep. I'll send an angel to cook for you." A and then go back to sleep again. And then we cook for you again, and then you can head on your journey off to Mount Horeb. So just one of the cures for us often, and one of the ways to avoid depression, because it's easier to avoid its depths than to get out of its depths, is if you find yourself feeling inexplicably low and increasingly de-energized, rest. It's kind of what depression asks you to do anyhow. It naturally is pushing you towards listlessness, and that's often exactly what the body needs. So God firstly takes care of his physicality quite beautifully. Then Elijah gets moving, he heads off to Mount Horeb. It doesn't seem as if this was God's idea, it was Ezekiel's idea. Ezekiel, let's get it right. Elijah's idea. One of those guys. One of those great men. We know Horeb as Sinai. It's like many places in the ancient world, it's got a number of names because there wasn't an official UN or National Geographic naming site. So Horeb is also Mount Sinai. It seems as if Elijah, apart from running to save his neck, wants to see God. And Mount Sinai seemed to be the place to go back. So he heads off down there. What does God do for Elijah when Elijah arrives at the end of his 400K journey? Well, having given him rest and food so he can get... Look at verse 9. He went into a cave and spent the night there. So he finally arrives, as it were, at the office place of God at Mount Sinai. And the first thing God lets him do is rest. Doesn't say, okay, you've arrived. Okay, well, let's talk. And again, I just want you to notice the way in which God is very keen on the physicality of the humans being dealt with. He needs rest before he has conversation. Secondly, they then have a personal conversation. And as so often happens with God, he begins conversation with friends and enemies with questions. Verse 9. What are you doing here, Elijah? And I don't think as if, it's not as if God is shocked. Elijah, what are you doing here? Like that sort of pleasant surprise or cranky surprise. I thought you were supposed to be serving me up in the northern kingdom. But it's just this beginning of a conversation. Elijah, why are you here? What's brought you to Mount Sinai? And Elijah gives a statement which he repeats later on, so it's obviously significant. Elijah replies, I've been very zealous for the Lord God Almighty. The Israelites have rejected your covenant. They've torn down your altars. They've put your prophets to death with the sword, and I'm the only one left, and now they're trying to kill me too. He says it again in verse 14. So it's kind of obviously something he's thought about. It's hard to know whether or not the tone of voice that Elijah's speaking, is this a complaint? You know, everyone's ripping your stuff apart. Your people have divorced you. They don't want you. I've been serving you, and I'm the only one left, now they're trying to kill me. Is he saying, what the hell's going on? Why are you letting it get to this point? Why have you let the game get out of control? Is it a complaint or is it a question? Has he gone to Mount Sinai to say, look, they have rejected you, they've torn down, they've murdered, I'm the only one left, but what are we doing now? We just did the Mount Carmel thing that should have convinced everybody, the evidence was clear, and yet still they don't repent, as so often happens. Is it a question? Either way, God interacts by him and says, stand by the mountain. The Lord is about to pass by. And we get this extraordinary scene of this God doing the stuff that I think Elijah thinks God should do. And I think humans generally think God should do, which is massive, obvious works of power. So verse 11. A great, powerful wind tore the mountains apart, shattered the rocks. After the wind, there was an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake, as the Lord had not been in the wind. After the earthquake came a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. These are three of the things that in past moments when God has come in really obvious way, particularly with Moses, which have demonstrated the presence of God. The wind, which is so mild sometimes but can actually tear cities apart, comes as a symbol of the presence of God. The earthquake, which happened when God came to Mount Sinai the first time with Israel, just showing how the thing that we know to be completely stable in the presence of God is completely fluid. And it turns it into shattering or fire, which is one of the great symbols of God's presence, the burning bush. But God wasn't in any of those. After the fire came a gentle whisper, a still small voice, a sound of silence. It's quite hard to translate the Hebrew, apparently. I can't translate any Hebrew, but the scholars tell me it's just a difficult phrase. It's got all those senses. It's the sound of silence. It's a gentle whisper. it's a still small voice. When Elijah heard that, not the earthquake or the fire or the wind, he covered his face because he was aware he was in the presence of God. So there's this sort of personal interaction with Elijah, which doesn't seem actually to satisfy him. Because God says to him, ask him again the question, what are you doing here, Elijah? And Elijah comes back with the same answer. I've been very zealous for the Lord. And now they're trying to kill me as well. So there's this sort of physical taking care of him. There's this entering into discussion. And then he gets a fresh encounter with God. Maybe teaching him that the way that you expect God to work is not the way God works. We expect God to work in big, powerful, shut up and notice this, and often yet it's actually the still, quiet voice where the real power of God is at work that transforms people and even nations. And then he's sent back to work. The end just says that God doesn't sort of answer all the questions that Elijah puts up, which may be because in the end, the questions that depressed people often ask are not really the questions that need the answering. It's more an emotional state, and because we're verbal people, we'll express it verbally. At least some of his questions do get answered. It's interesting what God does. He sends him back to three jobs. Anoint this Jewish guy to be king of part of Israel. Anoint this heathen guy to be king of the next door neighbor kingdom, showing that God is in control of all of history, and he's got work for Elijah to do. And then get yourself a companion, a God-appointed companion in Elisha to replace the servant that you sacked who wasn't worth keeping. And then, so it just seems that God sends him back to work, back to sort of serve him. Is Elijah cheerful again? I don't know. Is Elijah's suicidal depression over? Probably. Is his depression over? Who knows? An awful lot of people, sadly, serve God faithfully with their depression. My new doctor, when you're an old man, you're supposed to have a doctor. And I've been slapped around by enough friends who are doctors saying, you don't have a GP, do you? I just see them as friends. And they've told me to wake up to myself. So I've got this doctor, Richard, down in Canberra, who goes to the church I'm at. And he was mentioning some friends he's got who are missionaries in China. And he went across to see them a while ago, and he said, it is about the most depressing city I've ever seen. That beautiful communist architecture, terrible pollution, and they're working with a mostly Islamic tribal group in this huge dull city, and they're seeing extraordinary things happen. As you might know, it looks as if more Muslims are becoming Christians at the moment than any time in history. At least one serious scholar has been arguing that. But they're seeing quite extraordinary things happen. But he and his wife live on Prozac. They're a long way from home. They feel their missionary organisation has let them down. And they are depressed. But they're serving God wonderfully. But they know they're depressed. I think the trouble sometimes is that we don't say the words. And there's something very healing in simply saying, I'm depressed. I want to die sometimes. I don't want to get out of bed almost ever. And that just that straightforward honesty. Elijah simply sent back to work, which can be a healing thing in itself. But he's given a companion, and he knows that God has not rejected him. He gets a rest. He gets a renewal in his vision of God. We're not told his emotional state. We're simply told, because the Bible normally concerns itself with our activity rather than our emotional state, which is what concerns our culture probably more sometimes than our activity. And he goes back, and I think what we see here, and I'm going to be quiet now because we want to have some time for specific questions. That the God who's really met in the Bible is a God who understands what it is to be human. And understands sometimes to follow him in a world going vigorously in the opposite direction is almost soul-destroying. And can wear you out. And caring for all the people you need to care for and loving the nation as Elijah loved his nation, and yet opposing it, broke him to the point that he wanted God to euthanize him. And we see once again that God is the God, as Jesus says, come to me all who labor and are heavy laden, I'll give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and you'll find renewal and rest for your spirit. The Bible knows that in the end we're all quite weak. And you'll know, I'm sure, enough, because many of you I know read Bible, but you know, world changes like Churchill. Who would not be impressed by Churchill? Was he not regularly bedeviled by depression? And I think he used to call it the black dog, isn't what he used to call it? Some of my great heroes in the work of God lived with enduring depression. I'll just give you, Martin Luther's an obvious one. Let me give you one example, and this is the strange thing, and then I will shut up. Charles Haddon Spurgeon is a great Baptist preacher from the 19th century. I read two huge biographies of him when I was a young Christian. Massive thing, volume 1, volume 2. And then I used to read lots of his sermons. He regularly would illustrate his sermons from things he saw in Europe. But I'd read his biographies, he never went to Europe. So I'm thinking, how is that? Because he would say, I saw this in Florence and I saw this fountain here. I'm going, no, you didn't. You never. I've spent hours of my life reading your biography. It's only in more recent biographies. Here's what used to happen for Spurgeon. He would work away for God and various things would happen. He would fall into massive depression. And his doctors would send him to Europe to recover for a holiday, to rest. They had that worked out. And there he would gather these pictures that he would use. But in those days, we didn't talk about that. Because we thought somehow or other a great and good man who knows and trusts God won't get depressed. Nonsense. I won't bore you with many other stories, but I've got lots of others of really powerful men and women who did great world-changing stuff, but who lived with episodic depression, sometimes one massive depression. Adoniram Judson, another one of my great heroes, was basically kind of crazy for about a year or so with basically heartbreak and depression. And then he was brought out of it. Amazing man, powerful man, a mighty fine man, and yet lived with this brokenness of depression. I'll stop and be quiet there so there's time for specific questions on this material. And those of you who know the end of the story of Elijah's life, this is the guy, one of the only two men in the whole of the Bible who doesn't die. He gets taken home with a chariot of fire, where that name for the movie comes from. So God's obviously not embarrassed by this moody piece of work that he's got to deal with. Right, yeah. What do you think God's view would be on antidepressants and medication? I think, and I'm glad this is my opinion, I think God's view on antidepressants is the same view he has on glasses. There are some sorts of Christians, we've got a big and wide and crazy family, there are some sorts of Christians who say you shouldn't take it, it's a lack of faith, and I think if they're wearing glasses, they're being accidentally hypocritical. Right? We all know the world is broken, and we all know that our body gets broken. We're okay with some things, some people are not with others. I think if you've got a, this is what I've been saying, this family member does not want to take these antidepressants. I'm sure, having watched them live with anxiety and then the sort of inevitable depression that's come out of that for some years, physical sickness, which led them to be anxious trying to find a cure, and it's led them into this moment of depression. I think what they need is sort of a cast for their leg until it can repair, and then we'll see what happens. So I think that there are times when that's exactly what's needed. If you walk into a doctor and you say, I'm a bit sad, and they give you antidepressants, probably find another doctor. Because sometimes you're just sad. Sometimes people are sad because they've just had a series of grieving things, and they just need to work that out. If grief doesn't get worked through properly, it will often lead to depression. You may have unresolved grief from childhood, and if that's not worked through properly, that can lead to, it can be one of the things that exhausts the soul. And sometimes what you don't necessarily need a doctor who writes your prescription first time you come in. In fact, my advice would be run. There's lots of stupid doctors. Not as many stupid Anglican priests, but there are lots of stupid doctors. How should we ever retire? Incidentally, my shoes are made in Northampton. Okay. Now I can work out who this is. Retiring, this is another topic in a sense, but retiring, which Elijah doesn't do, and is a strange concept, that you should serve your community and gather expertise and then stop. And I think I would think a far healthier way is just to find other ways to serve your neighbour. You may serve at a more relaxed pace, which would probably be sensible, because many of us do. In fact, we had a workshop at our church in Waniasa on depression about 2 weeks ago. We got Dr. Morgan to come in and speak, and he said he thinks the fundamental reason, he can't prove it, but he thinks the fundamental reason for the massive increase in depression in the Western world, it's 1 in 10 basically, the statistics are pretty clear, 1 in 10 Australians that you meet is suffering from something which could be rightly labelled depression. If you're lawyers, it's even higher. As a profession, it's got a much higher percentage of people who will be depressed. In the ACT, where I now live, every 9 days someone kills themselves, which is almost always to do with depression. He basically thinks this. He said, the problem is we're living in a jet speed age, but we're designed at a camel speed. We're designed to live as humans at a camel speed sort of life. So we're just travelling too fast. Even in our pleasure, we travel too fast. So he said, everything we're doing is rushing, and therefore a certain percentage of us will break down in that way. And often it'll be the cleverest and the most sensitive. So I think retirement itself is a slightly... Elijah doesn't get to retire, but I think he does get to slow down. And he has a permanent God-appointed companion, which I think may be part of the cure that God has in mind for him to help him. Today, with fewer restraints on suicide, would Elijah have committed suicide? I doubt it, because you can be deeply suicidal and yet still be deeply conscious of God. So the classic cry in the Bible is the one that's at the heart of the cross, which is Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, which is a haunting cry where Jesus says, my God, why have you forsaken me? Quoting King David, right, who had that experience, where you feel God has forsaken you. But the cry itself is a godly cry. It's not a God-denying cry at all. It's calling out to God saying, what the heck is, what's going on? So it's a very godly cry of the sense of the absence of God. And I've certainly known, we had a young boy when I was at Shaw, who's still alive, thankfully, but who was, in year 8, was seriously suicidal. And we had this brand new chaplain sort of guy. He wasn't an ordained guy, but was sort of, better. This guy was asking him a question. He said, sir, he said, if a person trusts in Jesus and kills themselves, will they still go to heaven, or will that sin send them to hell? Because there are some older theologies that say if your last act is a mortal sin, you're in all sorts of bother. And this guy Cameron came to see us and said, I felt I had to say yes. You may well go to heaven anyhow. But he said, I wanted to say no. You'll be in all sorts of trouble. Don't even think about it. But in the end, it was interesting. What that guy said about a year or so later, when he was sort of out of that deep trough, he said, the thing that stopped me from killing myself was the fear that I might go to hell. And you may remember that one of the two Australians who became very clearly Christian in the Bali jail, when he climbed up to hang himself early on, before he became Christian, what made him stop was, he said, I suddenly thought about, okay, I'm going to be dead soon, what's there? And I had this echo that there was this, some people thought there was not just heaven on the other side, but hell. So I think the reality of God can be a helpful stop. I think Elijah wouldn't have committed suicide. But frankly, I think many of us will know people who we have reason to think were really genuinely caught up with God, but who got into such a dark place they did kill themselves. One of my daughter's close friends from school did that, and she was on suicide watch. Her parents were checking her room every 15 minutes, but in one of those 15-minute breaks, she hung herself in her wardrobe. And a clergyman who I don't particularly warm to spoke at the commemorative service and made a very good point. He said, her act has taken her out of our hands, but her act did not take her out of Jesus' hands. So Jesus says, you're in my hand and no one can pluck you out. And I think that's true. So I think people can commit suicide who trust in God as Elijah did, and God will still have the last word with them. Any specific advice for first steps to help suicidally depressed Christians, e.g. rest, food, chemicals? I, as you probably know, one of the first things to do is, in a sense, to do what Elijah did, although he did it to God, not to anyone else, is to verbalise it. There is something really helpful when we simply say what we're really feeling. That in itself can be a huge relief. But if if or when you feel like that, you really do need to talk to someone. Choose carefully who you talk to. And if the first person talks to you isn't helpful, do feel free to move on. But I think if someone is feeling suicidal, I think, yes, to talk to someone. And know that an awful lot of people will not be shocked. You may well. What surprises me, even in this new church I'm at down in Canberra, is the number of people I meet who are depressed, who are on permanent dosage to keep them well, in the same way as one of my daughters takes insulin. There are just some times where the body doesn't create enough serotonin. You can have the wrong sort of bacteria in your stomach and your body won't create enough bacteria. It's just the body's a complicated thing. The world is a bit broken. And so I think sometimes we do need to get help. And just to talk, I think I would suggest, yes, rest, food, but do get conversation with someone who you think's got some wisdom. How did Elijah know that Israel had ignored the miracle on Mount Carmel only one day past before he fled? Jesus' miracle didn't lead to mass conversions. What does this tell us about the human heart? Thank you. So the story is, massive public miracle, all Israel called to be there. Jezebel wasn't there, but Ahab was. Ahab goes back and tells her, but as he does in one of the other accounts, he doesn't mention God. I think he's frightened of his wife, who was keen on Baal, not the God of Israel. I think what happens, this is just my reconstruction. Elijah goes with Ahab back to the central control place, expecting spiritual renewal and revival, that the nation will turn back to God. It's obvious now that Baal is a nothing. It's been obvious by the 3 years of drought. It's obvious by the fire on Kor. It's screamingly obvious who's true and who isn't. I think Elijah rightly expects, after the trauma of the last years, that Israel repent, and they don't. Nothing has changed. Israel has not raised up against, you know, in some sort of rebellion against this king and queen, and Jezebel is unchanged and unfeared, unfazed. And I think his expectation was part of the thing that brought him undone. He expected this to happen, and it didn't, and all the sort of over-adrenalization, I think, breaks him. But I think it does indicate exactly what Jesus says, is that the darkness hates the light. It's not that it doesn't see the light, it hates it. And Jesus' famous story in Luke 16 about the man who goes to hell, he wants a miracle to shock his brothers, to wake them up while they've still got a chance to wake up. And Jesus, through Abraham, said, if they don't believe the scriptures, they won't repent if they see someone raised from the dead. It is one of the difficult things to believe, the hardness and the blindness of the human heart. That's why Jesus says, if you're willing to do the will of my Father, you'll know that what I'm saying is true. There needs to be a willingness to dethrone ourselves. Got another couple of minutes or not? Jonah. Where does he rate in terms of dummy spits? Yes, thank you, Jonah. The most unpleasant of the prophets, I think, and yet the most successful, which is a bizarre business. I think he asked to die, doesn't he? He asked to die because Nineveh have repented and been given God's mercy, and he hates them. It's a bit like, you know, the Queenslanders have repented and God has had mercy on Queensland. We go, oh, it's hell. That's what we need. It's that sort of thing. I think Jonah's up there. Thank you for that. Job's up there, but it's a completely different sort of business with Job. But I think the lovely thing is the way that God responds to his servants when they're broken or angry with him. He doesn't swipe them with a hand and say, how dare you speak to me? Although he could. He's got every right to do that, but he doesn't. He's tender with his children, like a father is with his children. Although the last thing is probably good to separate God our Father from your Father. We just have a natural tendency. If your Father's a harsh, perfectionist sort of person, you will have a very strong tendency to think God is like that. But God is like Jesus, who is tender with the broken. And then Elijah doesn't get to die. The only prayer that he prays that doesn't get answered, in fact, not only does God not kill him there and then, but he never gets to die. There you go. I think that's God's joke.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.